Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, Papal General Audience. On the eve of the Easter Triduum, the 3 days where the Church commemorates the Lord's Passion, Death and Resurrection, Pope Benedict urges the faithful to imitate Christ's loving obedience to the Father's will. John Paul's biographer tells his story. U.S. Catholic scholar George Weigel, who wrote 2 biographies of Pope John Paul and became his personal friend, looks back at the accomplishments and extraordinary legacy of his pontificate. Easter Triduum explained. As the Church heads into the 3 holiest days of the liturgical calendar, we take a closer look at the symbolism and meaning of the liturgies from Holy Thursday through to Easter morning and what they entail. And foot washing. Jesuit priest Father Chris Bowles reflects on the humbling and not always joyous task of washing other men's feet at the Holy Thursday evening Mass. At his Wednesday General Audience, Pope Benedict spoke about the coming Easter Triduum, the 3 days in which the Church commemorates the mystery of the Lord's Passion, Death and Resurrection. Emma McCarthy reports.
Today there is a certain callousness of the soul towards the power of evil, said Pope Benedict. That is also an insensitivity to God. This was the Holy Father's message as he dedicated his final catechesis before Easter to the Holy Week Triduum.
Tomorrow marks the beginning of the Easter Triduum, the 3 days in which the Church commemorates the mystery of the Lord's Passion, death, and Resurrection. The liturgies of these days invite us to ponder the loving obedience of Christ, who, having become like us in all things but sin, resisted temptation and freely surrendered himself to the Father's will. Tomorrow, at the Christmas Mass, priests renew their ordination promises. The sacred oils are blessed, and we celebrate the grace of the crucified and risen Lord, which comes to us through the Church's sacramental life. On the evening of Holy Thursday, the Mass of the Lord's Supper begins the actual Triduum and recalls the institution of the sacraments of the Eucharist and Holy Orders.
Reflecting more specifically on the episode of Christ's agony in the Garden of Gethsemane, in comments in Italian the Pope noted that, not unlike the apostles who failed to hold vigil with Christ and were overcome by a sleepiness, it's our very sleepiness to the presence of God that renders us insensitive to evil. We don't hear God because we don't want to be disturbed, and so we remain indifferent to evil. Pope Benedict said that Jesus experienced great anguish, such suffering as to sweat blood, aware of his imminent death on the cross, but he chooses to keep watch. This, says Pope Benedict, is a matter of great importance for the Church. Jesus says to his disciples, "Stay here and keep vigil," and this appeal to be vigilant concerns precisely this moment of his anguish, of threat. But it also covers the entire history of the Church. It is a permanent message for all time because the disciples' sleepiness is not a problem of that one moment, rather of the whole of history. The sleepiness is ours, of those of us who do not want to see the full force of evil and do not want to enter into Christ's Passion.
The Liturgy of Good Friday invites us to share in Christ's sufferings through penance and fasting and to receive the gift of God's love flowing from the Lord's pierced heart. The Easter Vigil joyfully proclaims Christ's resurrection from the dead and the new life received in baptism.
Pope Benedict concluded that by our prayers and our sharing in these liturgies of Holy Week, let us resolve to imitate Christ's loving obedience to the Father's saving plan, which is the source of authentic freedom and the path of eternal life. I'm Emer McCarthy.
I count on the support of your prayers and your goodwill in carrying out my mission of service.
Hey, John Paul, we can finish the race for you.
With just over 10 days to go before the beatification of Pope John Paul II, we are shining the spotlight more brightly than before on the incredible legacy of this Polish-born man who, during his long pontificate, set record after record and made history time after time. One person who became a friend of John Paul and had numerous private interviews and meetings with him is American Catholic scholar George Weigel, who wrote a best-selling biography of the Pope entitled Witness to Hope, published in 1999. More than a decade later, Weigel wrote a sequel to that biography called The End and the Beginning. Covering the last 6 years of the Pope's life, this book sheds new light on John Paul's fight against communism and explores his vast legacy. Weigel says his second book completes a promise that he personally made to Pope John Paul at a dinner less than 4 months before his death, saying that he would finish his story. Just over 6 years from Pope John Paul's passing, the Church is preparing to beatify him at a ceremony on Sunday, May the 1st in St. Peter's Square, where he'll be raised to the rank of blessed, the penultimate step before sainthood. Weigel is one of the hundreds of thousands of people who will be attending the beatification ceremony, and I asked him to share with us his thoughts about this keenly awaited event.
The world needs more than just social reformers. It needs saints.
I think this is a moment where the official judgment of the leadership of the Catholic Church is confirming the judgment of the people of the Church, which was registered at the Pope's funeral in 2005, namely that this was a life of heroic virtue. This was a man who can and should be held up as an example of a Christian life nobly and well lived. So it's all coming together, I suppose one might say, the Santo Subito of April 8, 2005, and the beatification constitute two bookends in one moment of the Church's reflection on John Paul II.
You're not surprised in any way at its relative speed in Church terms?
No, I am not, because the judgment was so overwhelmingly positive at the end of John Paul II's life that I think the canonical process, which has been a thorough one, marched ahead rather quickly. The only thing that has been changed in this process is that Pope Benedict XVI allowed it to begin immediately. And I think that was a response to the manifest desire of people all over the world that the Church take up this cause in a rapid way, but in a thorough way as well. And I'm quite satisfied that both those criteria have been met.
What do people in the US say to you about Pope John Paul's beatification, Catholics or otherwise? Are there any especially memorable remarks that have stuck in your mind?
Well, I've been in Rome for 2 months, so I have not been discussing this with people in the U.S. On a regular basis. I think there's great interest in this, and there's a great sense of satisfaction in it. John Paul II cared deeply about the United States, was a great friend of the United States, and was well received in the United States, and not simply in Catholic circles, but throughout a very diverse population. At the time of his death, I think one of the most striking obituary op-ed columns was published by a Jewish writer, Charles Krauthammer, in the Washington Post, in which he said this man embodied in some very special way the struggles of humanity in the last half of the 20th century, and we were all blessed by his presence among us.
Now, it's 6 years since his death, and a lot has happened since then. With the wisdom of this hindsight, What would you say are the most enduring accomplishments of this Polish Pope if you had to select, say, half a dozen or so?
Well, I think in the world's terms, it has now been widely recognized that John Paul II was the pivotal figure in the collapse of communism in Central and Eastern Europe. He was not the only major actor in that drama. There were others, Ronald Reagan, Margaret Thatcher, Helmut Kohl, Mikhail Gorbachev. But if you ask yourself, why did this happen in 1989 rather than 1999 or 2009 or 2019? And if you ask yourself, why did it happen the way it did, without violence, with the sole exception of Romania? I think you have to take into account the revolution of conscience that John Paul II ignited in Poland in June 1979. That revolution of conscience played itself out throughout the region over the next decade and provided tools of resistance that communism simply could not match. So in worldly terms, I think that's the accomplishment
in
that
spiritual
people will remember. In terms of the church, I think the greatest testimony came from Billy Graham at the time the Pope died, the great Protestant evangelical figure, who said this man was the greatest Christian witness of the second half of the 20th century. And that's what the church should remember. This was a radically converted Christian disciple who spent 60 years of his adult life inviting other people into friendship with the Lord, and who did that in a remarkably compelling way. I think John Paul II made the Christian proposal interesting and dynamic in a world that had imagined it had outgrown the need for religious faith of any sort, and that's an extraordinary accomplishment.
And also the way that he reached out to other faiths, surely that too really started.
He was a man whose secure grounding in the truths of Christianity, which he believed were truths for everyone, allowed him to speak to our Jewish elder brothers, as he called them, to Muslims, to people of no faith, to other world religions, to men of science, in a secure and compelling way. So in that sense, I think his beatification is going to be an ecumenical and interreligious affair, not simply a Catholic affair.
He has an extraordinary legacy. There's so much to it. But, you know, as a new blessed, how can we define his place in history? How can we encapsulate in a sentence or two?
I think he was a radically converted Christian disciple, and that is his connection to the rest of us. Very few members of this billion-member Catholic Church are going to have the extraordinary range of intellectual, literary, mystical gifts that were showered on Karol Wojtyła, Pope John Paul II. But we all have the possibility of being those radically converted disciples of Christ. And that was the core of him, and that's his connection to us. He invites us into a deeper discipleship, and that's what the Church will lift up at his beatification.
I was speaking to George Weigel, U.S. Catholic scholar and author of two biographies on Pope John Paul II. And next Wednesday, you can hear the second part of my interview with Dr. Weigel, where he shares with us his insights into the character of Karol Wojtyła, the man.
You taught us how to carry the flame and run to the ends of the earth. As
we mentioned earlier, the Church is heading into the Easter Triduum, the holiest days of the liturgical calendar, when we commemorate the birth of the Eucharist and priesthood, the Passion, Crucifixion and Death of Jesus, and then celebrate the joy of his resurrection on Easter morning. These coming days are also very busy and intense days for Pope Benedict here at the Vatican, as he presides over the various liturgies during this second half of the Holy Week. To find out more details about the significance, symbolism, and key features of the ceremonies during the Easter Triduum, I turn to Matthew Gamba, a Jesuit priest and communications expert from the Archdiocese of Chicago.
Let's look first at Holy Thursday, at
the Chrism Mass, during which the oils are blessed. Tell us a bit more about the importance of this Mass and what it all means.
It's a gathering of the local church, usually in the diocesan cathedral, and the celebration is centered on, of course, the Mass, but a principal secondary element is the blessing of the oils, which will be used by that local church through in all the sacraments during the following year. So the oil of the sick, the chrism, and the oil of the catechumens are all brought together and blessed and then distributed to the local clergy and parishes for their use throughout the year. It's a beautiful symbolism of the unity of the faith and the unity in these sacred oils which are used in the performance of the sacraments.
Okay, moving on to the late afternoon, there's the In Cena Domini Mass commemorating Christ's Last Supper with his disciples. And of course, we have this wonderful symbolic act where the Pope reenacts Christ's gesture of humility towards his apostles by washing the feet. Tell us a little bit more about this.
Yes, as you said, the Mass of the Lord's Supper, Holy Thursday, has three principal parts. The one you mentioned is the washing of the feet, which symbolizes the mandatum, the giving of the mandate, the love command. Love one another as I have loved you. Love until a sacrifice, a love in a sacrificial and service manner. But it's part of a troika, we could call it, in which the institution of the priesthood begins at the Last Supper and, consequently, the institution of the Eucharist. So it's the priesthood, the Mass, and then the love command.
Now then, let's go on to Good Friday, the day of Christ's Passion and his crucifixion. And we have here in the afternoon the ceremony where we commemorate his Passion. This, of course, has the veneration of the cross. There's quite a lot of symbolism here and particular things that are done, like all the other crucifixes are hidden away. Mm-hmm. Tell us more about that.
What's important is what doesn't happen on Good Friday is that the Mass is never offered. The final Mass has been on Holy Thursday, and it really opens one continuous liturgy until Easter. So there's no dismissal on Holy Thursday. The Church gathers again on Good Friday for principally to reread the Passion narrative again, as we did on Palm Sunday, to venerate the cross. The priest will carry it covered, and at three different points in the entrance, parts of the cross are unveiled in one, two, and three steps, and also to receive Holy Communion. But as I said, no Mass is being offered there. All these things to deepen the sense of what has transpired on Good Friday.
And the priest wears red vestments to symbolize the blood of Christ?
Correct. This is another day in which red is the appropriate color, liturgical color, because of the Passion representing the shedding of Christ's blood for us.
Moving on, of course, to the evening of Good Friday. Here in Rome, we have this very highly atmospheric ceremony of the Via Crucis, which takes place with the participation of the Pope in the ruins of the Colosseum. And there we see the Stations of the Cross. Can you tell us a little bit more about this?
Sure. The Via Crucis, the Way of the Cross, is celebrated in its particular way here in Rome, but it is celebrated throughout the world. You know, think of the great Passion displays in Spain or in Mexico and in other churches as well. The key liturgical moment is what we described earlier as the Good Friday liturgy, but there's many devotional aspects of Good Friday that are displayed in the streets and in homes and in churches and parishes. Here in Rome is this great Via Crucis that takes place at the Colosseum, mindful of the early Christians and their connection to Christ, and the Holy Father attends this as well, and special prayers. They're written every year differently by someone else, by a different clergymen usually. And so it's a really, again, a deepening of the walk with Christ in his Passion, kind of representing it in a more popular manner.
And how many Stations of the Cross are there?
14 traditionally, including the resurrection itself. And that's been added in many recent years. Some places do, some places don't. I believe it's not promulgated here in Rome. So it's the traditional stations that are usually line a church as part of the decor inside of a church that really follow as closely as possible the scriptures of Christ's last day on earth.
Okay, now we come on to Holy Saturday, where we, of course, have the Easter Vigil. It's where we commemorate the day that Jesus lay in the tomb. And also, like Good Friday, of course, as you said, there's no masses.
Holy Saturday day is completely silent until the evening vigil. And I love the church, you know, Easter is really the celebration, but we anticipate it so much that we begin the night before, you know, at sundown, really using that as our sense of time. And so again, the church gathers again, and it begins the celebration of the resurrection of our Lord. It will culminate in a Mass, but there's so many other elements that lead up to the Eucharist and then flow from that as well.
Tell us some of those elements, because of course we have the catechumens, the people who are formally joining the church.
Right.
You know, how did that come about? Tell us a little bit about what happens there for them.
The liturgy begins usually outside of the church with the blessing of the fire. And the fire is usually like a kind of a pit of some kind, depending on how elaborate a church can be. But then that fire is transferred to the Easter candle. The Easter candle is brought into a darkened church, and everyone is sitting there, but they hold their own little candles. And little by little, this Easter candle light is shared with the congregation, Christ, the light of the world. Then we go into a long series of readings recounting our salvation. This is really the Christian Passover night. And so we recall all that transpired in the preparation for the coming of the Christ and what he has accomplished. And then this leads into the Passover of the baptism. The catechumens who have been preparing throughout the year are themselves brought into the church. They die and rise again through the sacrament of baptism. They are given a candle. They are vested in white. They are anointed with those oils that we talked about from Holy Thursday. And then they are part of the congregation and will receive the Holy Eucharist for the first time that night. All this leads into the celebration of the Mass, as I mentioned, and then the distribution of Holy Communion, and the full celebration of Easter has begun on Holy Saturday night.
Okay, Easter Vigil, as you said, ushers in the joy of Easter Day and Christ's resurrection. And, of course, here in the Vatican, we have this traditional Urbi and Orbi by the Pope. Do we have any idea how long, when that was first started?
I think it goes back to very early days of the papacy, in which this was the key day. The Pope would always address the church in some manner, shape, or form. But as the church grew and it became more and more a worldwide church, you know, to the Urbi, to the city of Rome, but also to the world, and then it takes on different and greater expressions. Now it's from the balcony of St. Peter's Basilica and in all the languages of the world, and it's addressed to everyone this good news of Christ's resurrection. This concludes a whole morning of Eucharistic celebrations. Really, often many churches and many places have sunrise services. Some places they're even held outdoors. You know, the rising of the sun is a symbol of the rising of Christ. So Easter morning is this great morning of joy and the rising of the Lord and the celebration. And we mentioned colors. The color is, of course, white, festive color.
And sometimes gold?
Sometimes gold, yeah. Gold or white can be, the more festive, the better.
I was speaking to Jesuit Father Matthew Gamba about the Holy Week liturgical celebrations. Washing ceremony that reenacts Christ's gesture of humility towards his disciples at the Last Supper is seen as the most poignant and humbling moment during the Holy Thursday evening Mass. Scottish Jesuit priest Father Chris Bowles reflects on the joys and the drawbacks of performing this wonderful act of service, where over the years he has found himself washing the feet of those afflicted with bunions, deformed toenails, and other foot ailments.
What a great day, Holy Thursday. It's the beginning of our Triduum, where we recall Jesus having his Last Supper, leaving his last instructions, showing his last example, and praying that it's all going to continue when he's gone. Holy Thursday is the day we mark the birth of the Eucharist, the beginning of priesthood. And you'd have to agree these are pretty central to Catholic faith and to the Catholic Church. So does it strike you as odd, I wonder, that it's not our Holy Thursday Gospel. It strikes me as odd. Very odd. Very odd indeed. If it was left up to me, I'd probably have made the Holy Thursday Gospel all about Mass and all about priesthood and all about Holy Communion. And I suppose many others would have too. So, thank goodness it wasn't left up to me. Because what we've got instead is much, much better than that. The Eucharist isn't missing, of course. It's in the second reading, St. Paul describing it all in wonderful detail. And that leaves the Gospel clear for a very powerful act of service, Jesus washing the feet of the disciples. I love seeing that acted out at the Holy Thursday night Mass. I've been on the receiving end of the washing, and I've done the foot washing myself. It's actually pretty humbling, whichever role you take. Letting someone wash your feet is taking a big risk. And handling so many different feet isn't always a joyous task. On Holy Thursday night, over the years, I've had stinky feet, bunions, flaky skin, and horrible toenails. No doubt, feet had as many ailments in Jesus' time as in our own, and yet here he is, washing them, and telling his friends to do the very same thing themselves. And I'm coming to see more and more clearly that this is exactly what we should be doing on Holy Thursday night, and so I appreciate it more and more each year. We have an act of service on this most important night because, quite simply, that's the point of Eucharist. Eucharist isn't something private between me and Jesus, so that I sit in church for hours after Mass is over, feeling wonderful and precious because I've got the Lord inside me. We're not encouraged to hang around after Mass is over, except to say some prayers of thanksgiving. Well, think about it yourself. After we receive communion, we've got a quick final prayer, and then we're told, the Mass is ended. Go. Go, but go differently than the way you came in. Go in peace. And don't just go in peace. Go and do something too. Go to love and serve the Lord. Well, we can only love and serve the Lord through the people the Lord puts into our life. That's why this act of humble service is at the heart of Holy Thursday. Well, nowadays, not many people, I suppose, need their feet washed. When someone comes to visit, their feet are protected by tarmac pavements and by good shoes. But there are plenty more humble acts of service that we could be doing. It might be as much an act of service to ring an old friend that we're losing touch with, to tell them that we're thinking about them, as it is to wash their feet. It may be saying a kind word to someone, even when we think or we want to say an unkind word. Or it may be to give way. Give way in a queue, in an argument, or even in deciding what to watch on television. Holy Thursday can happen every day, because service can happen every day. How will it happen today, I wonder, and tomorrow? A very happy Easter.
That reflection came from Scottish Jesuit priest Father Chris Bowles from the city of Edinburgh. Well, that's all for today from me, Susie Hodges, here at Vatican Radio's English programme. But we'll be on the air again at the same time tomorrow. And you can always find our programmes on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. Laudato Jesus Christus.